We're going to take a short break for one of our sponsors. I haven't tried this one, but it looks well worth checking out if weight loss has been an ongoing challenge for you. Robody pairs medication options with diet and exercise modifications to achieve your desired goal. Before being prescribed any medication, patients complete an online medical visit, lab test, and more to see if you're right for their program. You can sign up online, which means no scheduling a doctor's appointment, no commute to the doctor's office, and no waiting rooms. Their data shows that average weight loss is 15 to 20% in 1 year with healthy lifestyle changes. BMI and other eligibility criteria apply. Go to ro.co/untangle. Sign up today and you'll pay just $99 a month for your first month and $145 a month after that. Medication costs are separate. That's ro.co/untangle. Now, back to our show.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Welcome to Untangle. I'm Patricia Karpis. This week, we've got a popular encore episode that aired in 2019 with Ariel and Dr. Dean Ornish. The focus? How you can optimize your health and heart by making lifestyle changes. Ornish Lifestyle Medicine was created to reverse heart disease without surgery or medicine, and the results have been pretty significant. As always, we're Untangle, the podcast from Muse, the brain-sensing headband dedicated to unlocking your brain's potential and revolutionizing health, and Meditation Studio, the five-star app. Check out all the free meditations at choosemuse.com/meditationstudio. Now, over to Ariel.
So this week we have a very special guest, a returning guest, Dr. Dean Ornish. Dean needs no introduction, but in case you haven't heard his name, he is the physician to many of the world's most amazing decision makers. He's a leader in lifestyle medicine. He was really one of the pioneers in the idea that what you eat, how you move, how you love affects and impacts your health. And he's doing tremendous work changing the way we think about medicine and ourselves. He was also just on Oprah's Super Soul Sunday. So I'm excited to hear all about what he and Oprah jammed about and learn from Dean's endless pool of medical knowledge and wisdom around the heart and the mind. Thank Welcome, you. Dean.
Well, after that introduction, maybe we should just quit while we're ahead and say goodbye. Thank you.
Let's say hello. Welcome. It's so wonderful to have you here.
Great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. So first question, inquiring minds want to know, how was jamming with Oprah on Super Soul Sunday?
Oh, well, Oprah's Oprah. You know, it's like playing one-on-one basketball with Michael Jordan, you know, or something along those lines, or Andrea Iguodala. She's wonderful. I've had the privilege of knowing Oprah for many, many years. And it was wonderful for Anne and me to be interviewed by her at her home in Maui. It was just a beautiful, in every sense of the word, and just nice to reconnect. So Oprah has a way of really bringing out the most personal things that most people wouldn't talk about, except maybe you. And so maybe we can talk about some of those today. You mentioned earlier that you wanted to talk about happiness, and we spent a lot of our interview talking about just that. So it'd be fun to take a deep dive into that with you today.
All right, let's dive into happiness. So what do you consider to be some of the preconditions for happiness? What are some of the happiest points in your life?
Well, my interview with Oprah actually started with one of the saddest times in my life, which was when I almost killed myself when I was 19. And kind of in the depths of despair and darkness and all the things that go along with that. And, you know, one of the hallmarks of depression is the sense of helplessness and hopelessness. And I think that comes from this reality distortion where you think that you're actually seeing things clearly for the first time when you're profoundly depressed. It's a real distortion of reality. and you're convinced that things are bad, they've always been bad, and they will always be bad. And anytime you thought otherwise, you were just fooling yourself. And so that's when, you know, ending your life suddenly becomes like, oh, why don't I just kill myself? You know, dead people look like they're happy, and I'm really miserable, so let me try that. I later learned that when you kill yourself, you kill your body, your spirit lives on, and now you just don't have a body, and you still have the same problems, and you have less opportunity. You've created a big mess in your wake. But that's how I got interested in my life's work. Was it's a long story, but short version is I withdrew from school, went home to Dallas. I got so sick physically from running my body down so much that I literally didn't have the energy to kill myself. I got a horrible case of infectious mono.
You may be one of the few people in the world saved by disease.
Yes, I was definitely saved by disease, which is a great lesson in life. Sometimes the things that you think are really awful are the ones that are actually life-saving, and that was certainly true for me because I didn't really have the energy even to get out of bed. And so my plan, as crazy as it sounds, was to go home and with my parents and who got a sense of how messed up I was, and they came down, saw what a wreck I was. I went home to Dallas, and the plan was to get physically strong enough to kill myself.
Wow. Wow.
This is in 1970, January of 1972. My older sister had been a child of the 60s and was helped a lot by an ecumenical spiritual teacher named Swami Satchidananda. And so my parents decided to have a cocktail party for the Swami. This was, even today, this would be weird in Dallas, but years ago, it was really weird. And so in walks this Central Castings looking guy from what a Swami should look like. You know, there's an old saying, when the student is ready, the teacher appears, and that was certainly true for me. And he began a lecture in our living room, a satsang, and he started off by saying, nothing can bring you lasting happiness, which I'd already figured out, which is why I wanted to kill myself, except he was glowing and radiant, and I was about ready to do myself in. And I remember thinking, like, what am I missing here? Although it actually felt validating even to hear him say that nothing can bring lasting happiness, because everyone else, you know, would always say, oh, yeah, just get married and get rich and famous and, you know, you'll be happy. And I knew that wasn't true. And so the combination of feeling like I was stupid and was never going to amount to anything, and even if I had, it wouldn't matter anyway, was profoundly depressing. So to hear somebody kind of validate my misery in a way, like that things don't bring lasting happiness, was initially validating. But then I thought, what am I missing here? Because he looks really happy, and I'm anything but that. And he went on to say what probably sounds like a New Age cliche, but it turned my life around at the time, which is that nothing can bring lasting happiness. That's the bad news that I'd figured out. But the corollary to that is that you have it already. We all do. That it's our nature to be happy and peaceful and healthy, with rare exceptions. And perhaps the ultimate irony and paradox, not being mindful of that, we end up running after all these things that our culture tells us are going to make us happy and say, gosh, if only I had more blank, more money, more power, more sex, more beauty, more accomplished, more whatever. If only I had more whatever, then I'd be happy. Then people would love me. Then I wouldn't feel so lonely and isolated, and life would be good. Now, what I learned from the Swami was that once you set up that view of the world, and not only our culture, but the whole advertising industry, you know, reinforces that, no matter how it turns out, you're going to feel unhappy. Because until you get it, you know, you feel stressed and unhappy. Well, I hope I get it, you know. Then the stakes go up, because it's not just winning or losing. It's being a winner or loser that's on the line. And losers, you know, I thought nobody wants to be around. I'll be even more lonely and isolated. And winners, everybody wants to love and be happy. So the stakes go up. So the stresses go up. So until you get it, there's stress. Until if someone else gets it and you don't, then it's really unhappy. And it makes you think, wow, we really live in this kind of Donald Trump dog-eat-dog zero-sum game view of the world. The more you get, the less there is for me. And you only go around once and better get it while you can. And all those, you know, Miller Beer kind of commercials. But even if we get it, it's seductive in the moment because it's like, ah, I got it. Now I'm happy. Except invariably, it doesn't last. It's like, it's either now what? One of my patients years ago said, you know, the view from the mountain I've climbed, I can't even enjoy the view from the mountain I've climbed. I'm already looking over the next one. Or if it's not now what, it's off. So what? Big deal. It doesn't really provide that lasting sense of meaning. And people say, well, you know, the letdown that comes from accomplishing a goal is so great, I always make sure I have a dozen other projects going on at the same time so I can immediately shift my attention to that.
Oh.
So it's either now what or so what. And so what the Swami said is that the goal of all these spiritual practices that we call meditation, for example, or yoga, or stress management, are really so much more than stress management. You know, the ancient you know, swamis and rabbis and priests and monks and nuns and mullahs and whatever, didn't develop these techniques and practices to unclog their arteries or perform better sports or get your blood pressure down or
be the best CEO. Yeah.
Yeah, whatever. They're actually powerful techniques for quieting down our mind and body to enable us to experience what's already there. In other words, our nature is to be happy and peaceful. And not being mindful of that, as I mentioned, we run after things that we think are going to bring us what we could have already if we just stop doing that. It's perhaps the ultimate irony or paradox. And you know, later the Swami who liked to make puns, people say, "What are you, a Hindu?" He'd say, "No, I'm an undo." You know, which is where the title of my new book came from. And that is that these techniques don't bring you a sense of peace and well-being, but rather, at least temporarily, they help us quiet down our mind and body enough to experience that it's already there. And then the question shifts radically from how can I get what I think I need in order to be happy and healthy and lovable to how can I just stop disturbing what's already there? What am I doing that's disturbing? Again, not to blame myself, but to empower myself. Because if it's out there, then everyone and everything that has something that I think I need to be happy has power over me. But if it's me, then I can. Then the question goes, what am I doing to disturb that inner peace? Then I can do something about that. And I found that to be profoundly liberating. And so I decided then, okay, let me move plan, killing myself down to plan B. You know, let me try this weird stuff. And he said, you know, if you eat a plant-based diet, which was a big change for me, having grown up in Texas, eating meat 3 or 4 or 5 times a day. And if you, you know, meditate and exercise and have more love in your life, then that'll do it. So I thought, okay, let me give that a try. And I couldn't even, you know, sit still long enough to meditate for a minute. I couldn't read a headline in a newspaper and tell you 5 minutes later what it said. But I began to do this and I began to get glimpses of what it felt like to be peaceful, not because I got something I thought I needed, in this case, going to medical school or getting into medical school, but rather, at least for the moment, I wasn't disturbing what was there. And that completely changed my life. And I was able to go back to school. You know, I went from being totally feeling like I was a total fraud and worthless and stupid to, you know, I graduated first in my class and gave the baccalaureate and all this stuff. And I say that not to brag, but to say I experienced both ends of that spectrum. And the profound irony was that when I thought I had to get and do all these things to be happy and lovable, I couldn't function at all. When I began to be more inwardly defined, even if just fleetingly, you know, just to make that connection, I was able to perform at a much higher level. And the other thing that happens is that when you quiet down your mind and body, it provides you access to not only your own inner sense of peace and happiness, but also you begin to hear that inner wisdom, your own inner Swami, your inner guru, your inner still small voice within. It goes by different names in different cultures. It's the voice that our inner wisdom. It's the one that wakes us up at 3 a.m. and says, "Hey, Dean, listen up, pay attention. You're not doing something that's in your best interest." And I've learned that I can access that voice much more intentionally. Everyone can. And so at the end of a meditation, whether it's done with a, you know, a mantra or a mindfulness or using a Muse headset or whatever way you get to that inner peaceful state, what I've learned to do is at the end of that, to ask that inner voice to say hello, you know, as crazy as that sounds. And it'll say hello. It'll say, "Hello, Dean," you know, and it may speak in your voice, it may speak in someone else's voice, but you'll learn to recognize it. Sometimes it's words, sometimes it's symbols or text or whatever. But for me, it's words. And I've learned to ask that inner wisdom a very simple but profound question, which is, what am I not paying attention to that I need to pay attention to? And then just to listen, and it will tell me. And all of the studies that we've done over the last 40 years, all of which people thought were impossible when we started them, came from that listening to that voice and then kind of reverse engineering to see how can I design a study to see if this is true or not. And the other thing that happens if you take it even deeper is that it gives you a profound sense of transcendence, that on one level we're separate, you know, you're you and I'm me, and we can enjoy having this dialogue. But on another level, we're part of something larger that connects us, that it's just, you know, you in different forms. Even to give it a name is to limit what's essentially an ineffable, limitless experience of oneness, of transcendence, of non-duality. It goes by different names. To me, anything that creates intimacy is healing. Even the word healing comes from the root to make whole, and yoga is from the Sanskrit to yoke, to unite, union. These are really old ideas that we're rediscovering. And so anything that brings us together, whether it's between people, the time you spend with your friends and your family and your loved ones, anything that creates that kind of intimacy. It can be romantic, it can be sexual, it can be a father-son or a father-daughter, a mother-daughter, or it can be with a dog, it can be with anything that takes you out of being separate and only separate is profoundly healing. You can only be intimate to the degree that you can open your heart and be emotionally vulnerable. You can only do that to the degree you feel safe. And so all these simple techniques are really designed to create that sense of intimacy is profoundly healing. And then you can go out in the world and often accomplish even more, but the intentionality behind it is very different. And so, and likewise, not only is there intimacy between people or having a pet or anything, but also to the extent that you feel that sense of transcendence, that non-dual experience where you're intimate with the entire universe. And so for me, having gone through what almost killed me, but you know, in retrospect was the most beautiful gift that I had, because I never would have gotten interested in these things otherwise. And I can't tell you how many patients have come up to me over the years and say things like, oh, wow, having a heart attack was the best thing that ever happened to me, or getting diagnosed with prostate cancer or whatever. And the first time I heard that, I went like, what, are you nuts? And they'd say, no, that's what it took to get my attention to begin incorporating these things into my life that I never would have done before. I'm rediscovering inner sources of peace and joy and love and well-being. I'm able to perform at a higher level. I'm having these experiences with my beloved that are the most erotic experiences that I've ever had. You know, whatever arena it happens to be in, when we go to that place of stillness and oneness and inner peace, the paradox is it makes our lives so much more joyful and successful and meaningful and healthy and happy.
So can we talk a little bit about the biology around that? What physically is happening when we get to that place of inner peace? What physically is happening from a biological level when we create connection that allows healing?
Well, our bodies have a remarkable capacity to begin healing, and much more quickly than I had once realized when I started doing this work, you know, 42 years ago. It's continually a source of amazement and delight to see that if we simply just stop doing what's causing the problem, our bodies can begin to heal. And as you mentioned, I helped create a field called lifestyle medicine, which is using lifestyle changes not only to help to prevent, but actually to treat and even reverse the most common chronic diseases. And the more diseases we study and the more underlying biological mechanisms we look at, the more scientific evidence we have to show how powerful these techniques are and how quickly people can get better to the degree that they do them at any age. And so in my new book, Undo It, my wife, Anne, and I are presenting this radical unifying theory, which is that I was taught, like all doctors, that all these different diseases, heart disease and diabetes and prostate cancer and Alzheimer's and so on, different diseases, different diagnoses, different treatments. But what I've came to realize over the four decades of conducting research is that it wasn't that we found that one set of diet and lifestyle recommendations could reverse heart disease and a different one for cancer or diabetes or whatever. It was the same for all of them. And what I'm realizing, and it's kind of an elegantly simple and yet profound theory, which is that they're really the same disease manifesting and masquerading in different forms, you know, most of these chronic diseases. And that's why they have because they all share the same underlying biological mechanisms, things like chronic emotional stress, overstimulation of the sympathetic nervous system, oxidative stress, changes in the microbiome and telomeres and gene expression and angiogenesis and so on. And each one of these mechanisms, in turn, is directly influenced by what we eat, how we respond to stress, how much exercise we get, and how much love and support we have. Or to radically simplify it even further, you know, eat well, move more, stress less, love more. Boom, that's it. And again, the more diseases we study, the more mechanisms we look at, the more evidence we show that. And, you know, with all this talk about personalized medicine and so on, I think if you're talking about a targeted immunotherapy for a particular cell type of melanoma or pancreatic cancer, that's awesome. But for the vast majority of chronic diseases, it's the same lifestyle prescription for all of them, because it's really the same disease that keeps manifesting in different forms. And it's why we're able to show how quickly people can get better in ways that they can feel, which then makes it much more sustainable, because it's like you start to connect the dots between what you do and how you feel. It's like, oh, when I eat this, when I do that, I feel good. When I do that, I don't feel so good. If you've got heart disease, I do this, my chest pain goes away. I couldn't walk across the street, people would say, without getting chest pain, before the light changes. I couldn't make love with my partner. I couldn't play with my kids. I couldn't go back to work without getting angina or chest pain. And in a week or two, most people are pain-free. Then they start to say things like, oh, I get it. You know, it's not about just preventing something bad from happening years down the road. These are changes that dramatically improve the quality of my life right here and right now. And because what I gain is so much more than what I give up, that makes it sustainable.
First of all, that's incredibly profound. And anybody who's struggling with having diseases, because so many people have strange diseases that doctors can't seem to solve. And you go from doctor to doctor and you don't know what the answer is. And in so many ways, some of the answer is right there in front of you. But can you really break down the biology of it? So loving connection, for example, we can talk about the fact that loving connection leads to less disease. Can you take a step by step through the biology of what's really happening?
Well, let's take loving as the fourth, you know, the love more, you know, eat well, move more, stress less, love more. So how does love more work? Well, love more works the same way that all these other things work, because if you go in the book, we go kind of mechanism by mechanism. So we know, for example, that people who are lonely and isolated and depressed are 3 to 10 times more likely to get sick and die prematurely when compared to those who have a sense of love and connection and community. I don't know anything in medicine that has that kind of impact in direct ways and in indirect ways. In direct ways, through mechanisms that we can talk about in a moment, indirectly because of our behavior. You know, in doing these studies, I had the chance to, you know, spend a lot of time with the same group of patients over a period of many years, and we got to know each other really well. And initially I'd say, you know, teach me something. Why do you smoke? Why do you overeat? Why do you drink too much? Why do you abuse substances? You know, why do you work all the time? Why do you play too many video games? These behaviors seem so harmful and maladaptive to me. And they look at me and they go, Dean, you don't get it. You don't have a clue. These behaviors aren't maladaptive. They're very adaptive because they help us deal with our loneliness, our pain, our depression, our isolation. You know, there's been a radical shift in our culture early in the last 50 or 60 years with the breakdown of the social networks that used to give people a sense of love and connection and community. You know, 50 or 60 years ago, people had an extended family they saw regularly. They had a job that they'd been at for 10 years or more. They had a neighborhood with 2 or 3 generations of people that they saw regularly. They had a church or a synagogue or a club or a mosque or whatever that they went to regularly. And many people today don't have any of those things. And we pay a price for that, because when you grow up in an extended family, they know you. They don't just know your Facebook profile or your bio sketch or, you know, all the nice things you said about me at the beginning of this introduction. They know all of you. They know your dark side. They know where you messed up. They know that time you got arrested or you were drug overdosed or you broke that window or got whatever it was, you know, and you know that they know, and they know that you know.
And they still love you.
And they're still there for you. They still love you. And there's just something.
We'll take a short break for one of our awesome sponsors, Born Shoes. I was so excited to try these cute, casual sandals made with top quality leather, perfect for all the traveling that I do. They're so comfortable for walking anywhere. I know exactly why their tagline is, "Take comfort in Born Shoes." Perfect. There are 5 new styles this spring, and I tried Ithaca and absolutely love them. But they also have boots and heels you should try. They feel as good as they look. Go to bornshoes.com today for a 15% discount plus ground shipping on all full price shoes when you use my promo code UNTANGLE. That's promo code UNTANGLE for 15% off and free shipping. Available exclusively to our listeners for just a limited time. Now, back to our show. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. We all carry around different stressors, big and small. We talk about these often on Untangle. When we keep things bottled up inside, it can start to impact our health mentally, emotionally, and physically. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, whatever it is. If this sounds like you, and it's a bit of all of us, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule and needs. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/untangle today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/untangle. Now over to Untangle.
Profound about that. One of the studies that we quoted in the new book is a study that shows the more time you spend on Facebook, the more depressed you are. And the reason is because it's not an authentic intimacy. It looks like people just post their best life. You know, it looks like, oh, everybody has this perfect life but me. You know, there they are in front of the Eiffel Tower. There they are, whatever. We all do that to some degree. But in our support groups, we try to recreate what you have growing up in an extended family, where people are encouraged to let down their emotional defenses and to talk openly and authentically about what's going on in their lives without fear that someone's going to judge them or criticize them or give them glib advice or whatever, which only has a way of making you feel more separate. And someone else can say, gosh, you know, I may look like the perfect father, but, you know, I really messed up badly. You know, my kid's on heroin, to use an extreme example. And somebody else might say, well, instead of saying, oh, well, why don't you send him to a drug rehab program, to say, wow, that must be really awful. My kid's got some problems too, or I've got some problems or whatever. Suddenly, yeah. It doesn't fix the fact that this guy's got problems with his kids, but it fixes everything in terms of the shame and isolation and loneliness and depression that come with that. I've had patients say things like, I've got 20 friends in this pack of cigarettes and they're always there for me and nobody else is. You're going to take away my 20 friends? What are you going to give me? Or food fills that void, or alcohol or opioids, or, you know, we have an opioid epidemic, or other drugs numb the pain, or video games numb the pain, or working all the time is a more socially acceptable way of numbing the pain. And so in our approach, we say, one of the things I learned from the Swami was he kept saying, what is the cause? You know, instead of literally or figuratively bypassing the problem. You know, I often show a cartoon when I lecture of doctors busily mopping up the floor around a sink that's overflowing, but nobody's turning off the faucet. You know, it's like, how long do I have to take these medications to lower my blood pressure, my cholesterol, and my blood sugar? And the doctor says, forever. It's like, how long do I have to mop up the floor? Like, forever. Like, well, why don't we just turn off the faucet? And over we find, again, our bodies often have a remarkable capacity to begin healing. And under a doctor's supervision, many people, and perhaps most people, can reduce or get off these medications they were told they'd have to take for the rest of their lives. Or they can often avoid having a stent or a bypass or a radical prostatectomy or get off these medications. And, you know, half the population today is diabetic or pre-diabetic, but getting your blood sugar down with drugs doesn't work nearly as well as getting it down with lifestyle to prevent all these horrible complications. And unlike most things we do, the only side effects of lifestyle are good ones. And so I think there's a convergence of forces that's finally making this the right idea at the right time, that it's not enough to focus on information. I mean, we're drowning in information in the era of Google. It's not enough to focus on behaviors. We need to focus on what's really motivating that. And for many people, it's this profound sense of loneliness and isolation. And so whatever mechanism you're looking at, I mean, studies, Liz Blackburn did a study with Alyssa Eppel, found that women who were caregivers of parents with Alzheimer's or kids with autism, the more stress they reported feeling, the shorter their telomeres were. And there was a 9 to 17 year reduction in their lifespan in the high stress versus the low stress women. But what I found was even more interesting was that it wasn't an objective measure of stress. It was the women's perception of it that determined its effect on their telomeres. And so you could have two women in very similar life situations, and yet one was coping with it better. They were meditating, they were exercising, they were eating healthier, they had a lot of social support. And so they could buffer and mitigate the effects of that. So it's not just what's out there, it's how we react to what's out there, which is often a function of how we perceive the world and these other social factors that can do that. So in the book, I kind of go through mechanism by mechanism, how, for example, not having enough love and isolation and having a lot of loneliness and depression and isolation can increase your risk of premature death and suffering through all these different mechanisms. Your sympathetic nervous system gets chronically stimulated. Your telomeres get shorter, as opposed to Liz Blackburn and I did at the first study showing we can actually lengthen telomeres when people meditate and do the kinds of things that we talk about in our new book that are the program. You know, so whatever mechanism it is, whether it's sympathetic nervous system, changes in the microbiome, changes in telomeres, we found that over 500 genes were changed in just 3 months when people made these lifestyle changes, turning on the genes that keep us healthy, turning off the genes that cause us to get sick, particularly the genes that cause heart disease and inflammation and prostate and breast and colon cancer and Alzheimer's and so on. And so our genes are a predisposition, but our genes are not our fate. And so the more we learn about these things, the more we can radically simplify and say, look, unlike most things we do as doctors, the only side effects here are good ones. To the degree that you make these changes, we found you're likely to get better in every way we can measure. I initially thought that the younger patients who had less severe disease would show more improvement, but I was wrong. It wasn't how old or how sick they were. The more they changed, the better they got at any age, which is a really powerful message to give people.
That's amazing. So I know love and connection is something that is very meaningful to you. And you've actually given me some great relationship advice over the years. And you and Anne have such a beautiful dynamic with one another, you and your wife. Can you talk to us a little bit about some of the, you know, mindset that you use, some of the things that you use that allow the two of you to have such a beautiful, flourishing relationship, and things that we may be able to learn from?
Well, I'm learning every day from her. She's my my teacher and my muse and my lover and my best friend and my partner. And we've been working together now for more than 20 years. And part of what I've learned is that, you know, having grown up in the 60s when it was all about, you know, do your own thing and free love and commitments are bad and all that, is what I realize is that commitment is actually liberating. And that the more committed you are, the more free you become. And that may sound like a real paradox. Now, this is true for lifestyle as well as for our relationships. You know, put in the case of diet, you know, all spiritual traditions have dietary guidelines. In some, you can eat this, but not that, or certain days of the week, or certain times of the day, or certain months of the year, or whatever. And they're sometimes in conflict with each other. But I think whatever the intrinsic benefit is of making certain dietary changes, just the act of choosing not to do something imbues those choices with meaning. When I was in college and I was suicidally depressed, I learned I could take all the meaning out of something, you know, as we talked about earlier. Who cares? So what? Big deal. Nothing matters. Why bother? You know, all of that. But later I learned that we can actually put meaning back into our lives. And one way to do that is by actually choosing not to do certain things. I think that's why all spiritual paths have dietary guidelines. Again, just the act of choosing not to do anything, is that deprivation? Well, it can be. Or is it helping you find the meaning? And why am I not eating certain things? Well, gosh, I mean, one of the things that my wife Anne likes to ask people is like, why are you here? Well, I want to live longer. Why do you want to live longer? Oh, no one's ever asked me that before. You know, there's an inherent, especially here in Silicon Valley, there's like everybody wants to live forever. Like, can I just transfer my, you know, brain into a silicon chip? When you get people to say, oh, I don't know, no one's ever asked me that. Well, I want to watch my kids grow up. I want to dance at their wedding. I want to make love with my partner. I want to write a book, whatever it happens to be. You know, this goes all the way back to 60 or 70 years ago when Viktor Frankl wrote that book, Man's Search for Meaning. You know, concentration camp survivors weren't the strongest or the healthiest. They were usually the ones who had the strongest sense of meaning and purpose. I have to survive so that I can whatever. You know, bear witness, be reunited with my loved ones, whatever it happens to be. So getting people in touch with that sense of meaning and purpose is really key. And then from our relationship standpoint, I realized that, you know, you can, as we talked briefly before, you can only be intimate with someone to the degree that you can be emotionally vulnerable. You can open your heart metaphorically. And you can only do that to the degree you feel safe. And so, you know, here in Silicon Valley, there's all this, you know, polyamory, and let's, you know, the more people you can have sex with, the more fun it is, the more free you are. And I went through, you know, in college, my own version of that, and it is fun. But what I learned with in my relationship with Anne is how much more fun it can be, that the more intimate it is, the more erotic it becomes. And rather than having the same kind of relationship with different people, we had this, you know, there's a Indian saying 100 years ago, Ramakrishna, who said, you can dig a lot of shallow wells and never reach water. You can dig one deep one and reach the wellspring. And so with Anne, we decided to commit fully and completely to each other, not only for this lifetime, but all lifetimes to come, just so there's no wiggle room. You know, you know? And said, and one of the things, and so a lot of things come from that. Let me just take a moment to kind of explain. The first is that if you're totally committed to someone, you know that eventually if you have a fight with them, you're going to get to a good place, right? So it's like, okay, well, if we know we're going to be together forever, if we have breaking up or getting divorced off the table, why don't we just learn the lesson and go straight to that happy place and leave out that all that stuff in the middle that's so horrible? And if you totally are committed to the other person, you can actually do that. And we're finding ways of doing that where we can get to that good place faster and faster.
That's one of the lessons that I learned from you, actually. You once told me that whenever you have a disagreement with Anne, you both ask yourself, is this worth it in the end? And most of the time it's not. So you just jump to the end. And that's something that I've really internalized and I really apply in my life here with my husband. Whenever we start to get something, it's like, is this worth it in the end? Nope. And so Then all of that discomfort and uncertainty and desire to be right and, you know, aggression with one another just off the table. Because You know the place that you're going to get to at the end is so much better. Just jump to there.
Yeah. And it means giving up the sense of needing to be right. Because if I'm right, that means you need to be wrong. And if you're wrong, you're not going to be happy. And if you're not happy, I'm not going to be happy. So why do I need you to be wrong? The real question is, what can I learn from this? How can we be clean mirrors for each other? Because we really have learned to trust each other. And when she says something to me, I know that she's trying to give me a gift here. And she's my teacher. And hopefully I can do that for her as well. And that's how we learn and grow. So it takes it out of the realm of, am I right and you're wrong, to what can we learn from this? Let's learn it and let's let it go. And let's get back to being happy and loving again. And the other thing that I learned is that, again, the more intimate it is, the more erotic it is. And to me, great sex or great music or great science or great art or great anything comes from that place of beginner's mind, you know, without preconceptions. I worked my way through school as a photographer, and I had a portrait studio when I was 14, and I worked for one of the leading photographers in Dallas where I grew up from 12 to 14, was his apprentice, and opened my own portrait studio and made these big pictures of people and tried to make them look better than they were. You know, with back then it wasn't Photoshop, it was airbrushing and retouching and things like that, and the way you light people and so on. And then when I went to college, I transferred to the University of Texas for my last 2 years so I could study with a photographer named Gary Winogrand, who was one of the great photographers of the 20th century, who just took a little Leica around and was photographing things as they are and not trying to manipulate them into looking better than they were. And he'd put a picture up on the wall. He was a great teacher. And he'd say, what do you see? And I'd say, well, people say, oh, I see this. He'd say, well, how do you know someone doesn't have a gun right outside the frame? Or how do you know this? Or how do you know that? Just challenging our preconceptions. And our preconceptions are really what limit us from true innovation as opposed to imitation. And so it goes back to talking to that inner voice within and trying to hear that. And so when we approach, when Ann and I decide to have a date together, we're not trying to recreate an experience that we've had before, however delightful or wonderful that experience might have been. We're going in saying, look, I totally trust you. I totally can open and be vulnerable to you physically, emotionally, spiritually. Let's just trust this process and see what emerges. And what emerges probably, you know, 8 or 9 times out of 10 is the most intimate, erotic, sexual, beautiful, playful, joyful, transcendent spiritual experiences that either one of us has ever had. This idea that the more intimate it is, the more erotic it becomes is something I never really heard before. And it's like layers of an onion. As you become more open and you have these great experiences, then you realize, oh, there's layers upon layers upon layers upon layers upon layers, which is kind of exciting in a way because it means we keep finding new ways of being intimate, keep finding new ways of pleasuring each other in ways that go beyond anything I've even ever imagined, much less experienced. We're like an unknown territory. And it keeps the relationship so fresh that even, you know, being together as many years as we have, you know, we keep having these experiences that are beyond anything that I ever even hoped for, much less experienced.
That's amazing. I mean, novelty creates a sense of joy, creates that dopamine rush. It, you know, brings you to aliveness. It brings you to engagement. And we usually experience that novelty only when we're with a new partner at the beginning of a new relationship. And then it just stales out so easily after 2, 5, 7, 10 years. And to be able to, I think this is going to be meaningful for most people who are listening, to be able to shift the lens on your existing relationship and say, I can go into this from a place of complete novelty. And with that novelty, you know, comes a little bit of fear and comes a little bit of like, I'm standing on the edge of uncertainty. I'm going to step over this threshold. It means being vulnerable. It means both of you being vulnerable with one another, which just ups the excitement ante, which ups the opportunity for new and deeper connections.
Yeah, well, it keeps it fresh and juicy and fun and all those things. So, you know, being with different partners after a while actually gets boring because you're having the same kind of experience with different people as opposed to these uniquely, powerfully erotic, joyful, pleasurable experiences with the same person. And, you know, there are times when I think, gosh, you know, I'll see someone attractive and I think, gosh, it would be really nice if I could have sex with that person too. But then I realize that if I did, I wouldn't be able to have these experiences with Anne. And again, it comes down to what I gain is so much more than what I give up. It's from a place of I'm choosing not to do certain things, not out of a sense of fear or deprivation, but out of a sense of joy and pleasure and love and feeling good. And that's ultimately what makes it sustainable.
How is it to have this conversation with you and Anne and Oprah about commitment and sexuality?
It was great. You know, I think that's what people, you know, we are motivated by a sense of pleasure and joy and intimacy. All of the great spiritual truths kind of come down to what Aldous Huxley called the perennial philosophy, you know, that when you reduce it down, once you get past all the rituals that people fight and kill each other over, no, my religion's best, you know, no, my religion's best or whatever, is like, you know, altruism, love, forgiveness, compassion, ultimately take us to that place that it frees us from our suffering. And so we realize that those spiritual truths are how to live a joyful, pleasurable, happy life. You know, that's what people have kind of come to over the millennia, and we kind of ignore that. And so I think once people begin to realize that those are the spiritual truths that liberate us and make life so much more fun, not out of a sense of, you know, dry and moldy and boring and stale and old, but rather these are the things that really enable us to live the most joyful and pleasurable life. Again, if I forgive somebody, it's not condoning or excusing what they've done, but it helps to free me from the suffering that goes along with that. You know, on one level, we're separate. You're you and I'm me. On another level, as we talked about earlier, we're not. But to me, the roots of suffering begin by seeing people as separate and only separate, the other, you know, which we're seeing in the, unfortunately now, with the rise of white supremacy and in the White House and so on, the other, those Mexican rapists, those Muslim terrorists. Once you call someone different and only different, then you can do bad things to them because they're not you. And that only creates more isolation and more suffering. And I think, you know, there's a wonderful conversation George Lucas of Star Wars had with Joseph Campbell when he was talking about the Star Wars myth and the whole Darth Vader, and that, you know, when you have that sense of the other, then no one is safe. It's the opposite of that, what we were talking about before, about being trusting and open and intimate. It's very protected and walled off. And when you're walled off, those same walls that protect you isolate you. And the more isolated you are, then the more likely you are to get sick and die prematurely. So the very thing that we think we're doing that's protecting us is the very thing that's actually killing us. And so the logical conclusion of that, George Lucas was talking about with Joseph Campbell, is that you can't trust anyone. So basically you're down to two people, the master and the student. And eventually the student ends up killing the master, which is the whole Star Wars myth. And that's what we see. You know, Donald Trump, you know, by all accounts has no friends, you know, is a miserable, unhappy, isolated person, and kind of projects that and now, unfortunately, onto the rest of the world. And so I think that as we really understand these deeper spiritual truths, to me, they're the root of not only having, saying, healthy and living longer, but having a joyful, pleasurable, loving, happy life. The Swami that I studied with was one of the happiest people I'd ever met. You know, if you ever hang out with the Dalai Lama, he has this beautiful laugh. I mean, that's why they sampled his laugh for Yoda, because it's just a joyful laugh. And yet he's been witness to the whole genocide of his people. We have the ability to use the experience of suffering as a doorway or as a catalyst for transforming our lives, of rediscovering that happy place, that inner peace of joy and love and compassion and so on for ourselves and for others. And it's just a way to kind of go through the world in ways that make it so much happier as opposed to creating more suffering.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you for reminding us of the joy that happens when our fears drop, when our hearts open, and when connection is made. And thank you very much for reminding us of the health. See, we tend to think about just the, you know, spiritual benefits or the happiness benefits, but as your research has shown, you know, study after study after study, the health benefits just keep rolling in.
Yeah. And the more diseases we study and the more mechanisms we look at, the more scientific evidence we have for that. And to me, that's part of the value of science, is that it can redefine what's possible for people. And by doing so, it gives many people new hope and new choices. And the, you know, when someone is sick and suffering, just like when I was depressed, there's a receptivity to new ideas and to change that you wouldn't find otherwise. And so like someone's had a heart attack, they'll say, God, this stuff is so weird. You know, you want me to be a vegetarian, eat a plant-based diet and less sugar and less fat and exercise and meditate and love more. Are you kidding me? You know, that's what doctors say. I can't even get my patients to take their statins. You expect them to do all this stuff. And yet we find that, you know, Medicare is now covering our program in hospitals and clinics around the country. Most of the major insurance companies are. And we're getting bigger changes in lifestyle, better clinical outcomes, bigger cost savings, and better adherence than anyone's ever shown. You know, our program is 72 hours long. 94% of those sessions get completed over a 9-week period. And a year later, 85 to 90% of the people are still following them, not only in big cities, but in Salinas, Arkansas, and Jackson, Mississippi, and, you know, South Bend, Indiana, and so on. It's working, because when we work at that level, which is really core to the primal need for love and connection and community, we find that people are much more likely to make lifestyle choices that are life-enhancing than ones that are self-destructive. And because these underlying biological mechanisms are so dynamic, most people, when they make these changes, to the degree they make them, feel so much better so quickly in ways that really matter to them. Not only the chest pain going away and the, you know, the physical things, but depression scores are cut, you know, more than in half on average. Then they sometimes again go back to saying, wow, getting sick or being suffering, having that suffering in my life was a blessing in disguise because it got my attention to begin being open to doing these things. Unfortunately, in medicine, we're not trained to see that as an opportunity. We're trained to numb the pain or kill the pain or bypass the pain, literally or figuratively. And so the reason I spent 16 years to work with Medicare to get coverage of our program is that I learned that if it's reimbursable, then it's sustainable. And if you change reimbursement, you change medical practice and even medical education. So part of what I'm so passionate about is helping teach medical students and others how to use the sacred opportunity that we have to work with people when they're often and they're most vulnerable and they're most suffering, and to show them how they can empower themselves, not only to get better physically, which we can often measure, but to deal at these deeper levels, which ultimately are that much more meaningful and profound.
Thank you so much, Dean, for showing us the opportunity and the possibility there for all of our lives and all of our health. Now, if anybody wants to learn more, which I'm sure everybody does, about how to love more, stress less, exercise more, and eat better to live your best life, you can pick up Dean's book, Undo It, like the Swami Undo. Pick up Dean's book, Undo It. I've read it cover to cover and love it.
Thank you. Also, they can go to our website, which is just mynameornish.com. And a lot of the stuff we talked about today, everything on there is free, a lot of resources, as well as the locations of the sites that we've trained around the country with ShareCare.
Awesome. So that's ornish.com. All of the information will be in the show notes. Thank you so much, Dean.
Thank you. It's really great talking with you. Thank you for inspiring me. I don't usually talk about these things in this level, and I hope it's been useful. So thanks, Ariel.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Dean Ornish. Now, you heard Dean mention Muse. What is Muse? Muse is actually a brain-sensing headband that helps you meditate. It gives you real-time feedback on your brain during meditation. If you're a beginner, it really shows you what your brain is doing, teaches you how to meditate, and helps you get into that state of focused attention, the meditation zone, if you will. For those who have an experienced practice, Muse actually shows you what your brain is doing moment by moment in your meditation to give you new insights on your practice. There are hundreds of thousands of people that use it regularly to help them begin or enhance their practice. Meditation is one of the key pillars of Dean's program. You want to find out more about Dean's work? It's all up at ornish.com. And his amazing book, Undo It, is a great blueprint that may help prevent or even reverse disease. So, till next week, keep meditating, keep loving, keep eating well, keep exercising, keep happy, and keep your neurons sparkling. We'll be back next week with more Untangle.